It's almost fitting that my children's sermon this morning happened to be about show-offs. Not that I was a show-off growing up when it came to school, but when it came to my very first summer job, I absolutely relished being a show-off. I was 16, 17 years old, and I worked for a moving and storage company. And being 16 and 17 years old, playing sports, working out, I loved getting the chance on a day-in, day-out basis to pick up heavy things and to throw them around. And I loved to show off the fact that I could pick up heavier things than people who were twice my age and had been doing this job for twice, if not three times as long as I was. I didn't realize at the time they were just much smarter than me, but I just loved the fact that being 16, being, you know, 6'8", having all this strength, all this leverage, you know, I'd go up to a great big dresser and the guy's waiting for somebody, hey, can you give me a, you know, hand moving this, and I'd push him out the way and I'd, you know, bear hug this stupid dresser and drag it across, and he's looking at me like, dude, you are an idiot. But I loved doing this on a day in, day out basis. It was dressers, it was couches, it was, you know, just the biggest pieces of furniture I could find. I just loved to show off. And so there came a day that we were on the very first job I was going to be working with where there was a grand piano to be moved. And the guys sort of had this look of fiendish glee in their faces as they realized that I was going to be on this job with them. Now, they had already taken the liberty before we got there of having taken the piano apart, and they'd taken the main piece of the piano and put it down on what's called a piano board, which is basically a long padded piece of plywood that has four handholds on it. And I'm looking at this thing like, you mean to tell me it's going to take four people to move this grand piano? Now, I recognize I couldn't move this thing by myself, but I'm like, surely two of us should be able to do this. We don't need four. And so I get the other guy on our team that I'm sure is the other strongest person there. I'm like, we're going to slug this piano around. We're going to show off. He's like, yeah, sure we are. So he played along with me. And I remember going over to this piano and going for that very first handhold and just expecting to grab it and pick it up. And I looked at it and thought, why didn't it move? So I tried it like four or five times before I suddenly realized, we ain't moving this piano without four of us. And it took four of the strongest men on our team to get this thing far enough off the ground to put it on a rolling dolly so we didn't have to pick it up anymore. There comes a point in your life you need to realize a very key lesson. You cannot do everything by yourself. Some of us take a lot longer to learn that than others, but you can't do everything by yourself. You need other people along the way. You learn that very early on in marriage. I had a chance to officiate a wedding yesterday in Snow Hill, Maryland, and as I'm in the car on the way down, I heard a testimony on the radio from Mark Hall, the lead singer for Casting Crowns, that was talking about his marriage. And then on the way home, I heard a testimony, I think it was from Brandon Heath, talking about his marriage, these, you know, two Christian artists that are now married. And the thing that they kept coming away with is, I learned when we first got married how selfish I had been. And it's true. You suddenly realize that not only do you want that other person along the way, but you need them. You need that other individual in your life to get through life on a day-to-day basis. And all of us that are married understand that. You realize that when it comes to parenting. I pray every day for people who, for whatever reason, find themselves as single parents. Because parenting is hard enough when you got two people, and then if you include, you know, grandmom and granddad and everybody else in the mix, you need that whole village because kids are exhausting. I think about this. My wife's been away for the weekend at a conference in Portland, Oregon. And I just look at myself every evening like, I wish you were here, Lindsay. Please come home. You know, it's very, very hard to get through these, you know, these full days. So you need people along the way for that. You learn it through work. You learn it through life. You need other people along the way. You need the right kind of people that can help out when times really get hard. The right kind of friends that will be there when you actually need them. We get this story in this lesson in a very powerful way this morning through our lesson from the book of Exodus. We'll be in Exodus chapter 17 this morning, and we're going to pick up at verse 8. So that's Exodus 17, 8 through the end of the chapter at verse 16. That's on page 58 in your pew Bible. In Exodus 17, starting at 8. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, "Choose some of the men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side and one on the other, so that his hands remained steady until sunset. And so Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven." Moses built an altar and called it, "The Lord is my banner." He said, "Because hands were lifted up against the throne of the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation." I find this to be a very unique experience in the life of Moses. And we've highlighted through this entire series so far, if ever there was an individual in the Old Testament that could bear the title of the man, it's Moses. Moses is the man. He is the leader of this people. He has championed them. He has been at the forefront. He's stared down Pharaoh. He's led the people out from slavery and into the wilderness. He's taken them down to the Red Sea waters, and then the waters parted, and he led them through. And immediately preceding this passage, two different things have happened. The passage that Pastor Dave preached on last Sunday, where the people had grown very weary and very hungry, and the Lord provides them with manna and quail, but it was, of course, at Moses' prompting and praying that the Lord responded. And then, right immediately in the passage before this, the people were now thirsty in an area where there was no potable water, and the Lord instructs Moses to strike this rock with his staff, and water comes pouring forth, and the people can now drink. Now, notice that everything has been done, of course, by God's hand and by God's power, but it's been Moses at the front. There's somewhere between 2 and 2.5 million people that look to Moses for leadership. Not that many of them know Moses on a face-to-face, individual-type basis, but they know who Moses is. They recognize his voice. They recognize his leadership. They recognize the power of God that rests within him. And so Moses is clearly the man. They look to him, and whatever Moses does, they will follow. And so now they find themselves, for the very first time, in battle. Rephidim is in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula. If you look there, you got Egypt and the rest of Africa on the left, Israel, what will become Israel and the Promised Land, going up to the northeast. The Sinai Peninsula rests right in the very middle of it. The body of water is the Red Sea, and the Red Sea kind of comes up in these two little extensions that cuts the Sinai Peninsula to make it look like a great big triangle. So the people have crossed through the Red Sea waters on the west side. They've now traveled down a little bit, and somewhere in the vicinity of Mount Sinai, they now are chance upon this group of Amalekites, the descendants of Amalek. From this time forward, for the people in Israel, they will identify the darkest evil as being Amalek. To hear the name Amalekite or Amalek just makes the people bristle. And you hear it here in the Lord's admonition that the Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation. Later rabbis, when they're trying to think about the deepest evil, they think of the Amalekites. When they want to identify as somebody being evil, they identify them with the Amalekites. The Amalekites are a wicked, terrible people, very fierce, very warfaring, and the people of Israel are going to be in over their head fighting against them. And it could, again, this is they're kind of teetering on the edge here, where if they lose this battle, then what are they going to do? They're immediately going to beg to go back to Egypt all over again and go back to slavery and go back to where they had previously been. If they can manage to gain victory, they will get to go forward and hopefully have their confidence built and be ready to do amazing things in God's name. And so it all comes down to Moses. Moses sends Joshua and the troops into battle, and he says, "I'm going to take myself and this staff up on this hillside, and I'm going to overlook this entire thing." The staff was more than just a thing that Moses walked with, but this is the symbol of God's power that rests with him. This is the staff that he could throw down and have it turn into a snake. This is the staff that he held aloft as the Red Sea parted. This is the staff that has been along the way, and the people see Moses, and they see the staff, and they know that God is with them. And so he's high up on this mountainside, and as it would turn out, as long as Moses keeps his hand with his staff out like this, the people feel strong and they start winning. But go home today and grab a broom handle and just sit there for a little bit with your hands out. And in depending on who you are and what your life looks like, at some point, maybe it's in a few minutes, maybe it's in a few hours, but your shoulder muscles, your deltoids are going to start burning. You're only holding a broom handle. You're not even lifting a lot of weight, but just holding that position, you start to feel the pain, start to feel the burn a little bit. Now, if Moses was a stereotypical alpha male, he would have just stood there and just grunted and gritted his teeth, and he would have grasped onto this staff even harder, and he would have been shaking, and he would have been just crying out in pain, but he was no way he was going to accept help. But he can't do that because he recognizes the minute he drops the arms down, suddenly the armies of the Amalekites start winning again. So he picks his arms back up, and it's a down up for some time before he realizes we're going to lose if we keep doing this. And so what is Moses going to do? What I find interesting is that Moses didn't go by himself up the hillside, but he brought his brother Aaron, and he brought this other man named Hur. And they're up on the hillside together, and Aaron and Hur, recognizing what's going on with Moses, they have the idea. Let's get a rock and have you sit on it. And then as you sit there with your arms extended, Aaron says, I'll stand on one side and hold this arm up. And Hur goes on the other and he holds the other arm up for the entirety of the day until evening falls, so that Moses isn't there by himself. No matter how strong he was, no matter the depth of his character, no matter the strength of his resolve, he could not have done it by himself. And Moses was a big enough man to lean on these other two guys, quite literally. And for that, the people are given victory. It's a key lesson for us. The reminder that we need true friends. And depending on who you are and how you're wired will depend on the number of true friends you necessarily think that you do need. If you are a true-to-form extrovert, maybe you've got four, five, a half dozen or more people your absolute true friends. If you're like myself and more on the introverted line, you'll settle for one. But you got to have some group or a person in your life that you can call on, that you can lean on in any of life's circumstances, but especially spiritually. We need true spiritual friends. It's hard enough following Jesus on a day-in, day-out basis when you try to do it by yourself. You need other people along the way, and there's a number of reasons why. For accountability, to hold one another accountable. To have somebody so intimately woven into your life that they know what's going on with you and you know what's going on with them, and you can check in with one another. How's everything going? You can carry a burden to them. You can call on them for prayer. That you can call out to them, like, I'm really struggling with this thing that I don't want anybody else to know about. And that person will both hold the confidence, but also make sure to check back in with you to say, how's that thing going? What can I do to help you through it? You can call on them for prayer. Calling them for comfort, calling them for support. These are the truest and the deepest type of friends that we can have. Reflecting on that list of names that we just lifted for All Saints Day, it's the true saints of God that understand this. It's the true saints of God that understand this. Now recognize within the Protestant tradition when we say saint, it's a dramatically different thing than our Catholic sisters and brothers. They have a long laundry list of things one has to do to achieve sainthood. What we're looking at as saints are members of the communion of saints. This great cloud of witnesses the author of Hebrews talks about, these faithful ones that have gone on before us, that have, in the words of a hymn I grew up singing in the Episcopal Church that we're going to do at the 11 o'clock today, who toiled and fought and lived and died for the Lord they loved and knew. When you think about the reason that you still have your faith in Christ, you can probably start listing off a number of different people that have made an impact on you over the years. Sunday school teachers, pastors, parents, grandparents, neighbors, just faithful members at some church you attended for however long it was, but this group of individuals who, in the grand pantheon of eternity, nobody knows their name, but they matter to you. It was a pastor who had tweeted out this past week on All Saints Day itself that within the church, we don't have this ring of honor. We don't have a Ring of Honor like so many of our sports teams do with, you know, names emblazoned on it, you know, celebrating their great accolades. What we have are sinners redeemed by the grace of Almighty God and brought into the fullest presence of Him through Jesus Christ, their Lord, through Jesus Christ, our Lord. It's the saints that recognize that you can't do everything by yourself. First and foremost, you need Christ. You need Christ at the center of everything you do. You need Christ at the center of your family, Christ at the center of your business, Christ at the center of every relationship you've got. But likewise, they recognize that being part of the communion of saints is not something we're looking forward to one day, but we're part of it now. And that's the key thing about being part of a church community, being drawn together through worship, through prayer, through fellowship, that we can't do everything by ourselves and we don't have to. And Christ doesn't want us to. If Moses could learn that lesson, if Moses could recognize that, we need to as well. Let's bow together for a word of prayer.